Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Marge Baker of the group People for the American Way, who talks about how the outcome of this November's presidential election could affect the future ideological composition of the U.S. Supreme Court. George Farah, founder and executive director of Open Debates, who explains why his group and others are demanding full disclosure of the secret contracts governing U.S. presidential debates. And Ron Seifert with the group Tar Sands Blockade, who discusses the ongoing nonviolent civil disobedience protest actions in Texas opposing construction of the Keystone XL Tar Sands pipeline project. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In late 2001, gunmen from the U.S.-supported Northern Alliance, loyal to ethnic Hazara warlord Mohammed Mohaqiq, swept through the village of Kampirak, a mostly Pashtun enclave in northern Afghanistan, killing scores of villagers. The surviving women and girls were rounded up and sexually abused by the gunmen, reports News magazine In These Times. Since the start of America's 11-year intervention in Afghanistan, Western governments have pumped in over $60 billion to rebuild the Afghan economy, construct schools for girls, and subsidize health clinics. But none of that aid has made it to the women of Kampirak due to mismanagement and massive corruption under President Hamid Karzai. The Pashtun village has no electricity, little running water, and no health clinic. Over the last year, Taliban scouts have been seen near Kampirak, collecting a 10% tithe for jihad and threatening to kill anyone who helps the government. The Taliban have also destroyed cell phone towers, limiting mobile service. But villager Zar Bibi told a reporter, "The government has done nothing to help out. In contrast," she says, "the Taliban were good for security. We were always safe." Women's rights and social reform have always been a hard sell in Afghanistan. The high point for women's rights came during the Soviet occupation, when many urban women enrolled in college and worked outside the home. Reforms collapsed after the Soviets retreated and the fundamentalist Islamic Mujahideen took over. In the late 1990s, the Taliban burnt the last girls' school in Kampirak, and as of this date, it has not been rebuilt. Housing prices are starting to rise again after years of plunging home values due to the 2008 mortgage crash that put millions of homeowners in underwater mortgages. In June, the Standard & Poor's Case-Shiller Index of the top 20 cities reported rising home values for the fourth straight month. Mortgage delinquency and foreclosure rates have also begun to fall. The Los Angeles Times reports cash-rich investors, including private equity and hedge funds, are actively buying homes in depressed markets. Rents are rising, and young families have moved in with their parents to save on housing costs. Yet consumer confidence is now rising. But even as prospects for the housing market look brighter, the Federal Reserve has criticized major banks for employing unnecessarily restrictive lending standards, which effectively limit the supply of mortgages across the nation. A new report by the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, the controller of the currencies, and several universities blames big banks like Bank of America and Citibank for derailing 800,000 loan modifications, which diminished the impact of the Obama administration's Home Affordable Modification Program, designed to help homeowners avoid foreclosure. Confronting a congressionally mandated fiscal cliff at the end of the year, when a combination of $560 billion in tax hikes and spending cuts could become a reality, private sector economists are calling for a program of tax increases over the longer term to shrink the federal deficit. The fiscal cliff of expiring Bush-era tax cuts and automatic spending cuts was established after the failure of talks between President Obama and congressional Republicans to craft a $4 trillion 10-year deficit reduction deal. A survey by the National Association of Business Economics found broad support for equal amounts of tax hikes and spending cuts to trim the federal deficit. Business economists firmly reject the Republican Party's no new tax pledge and Mitt Romney's proposal for revenue neutral tax reform. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office projects that should the nation go over the fiscal cliff with its tax hikes and spending cuts, the economy would suffer a 0.5% decline in 2013, plunging the nation back into a significant recession. With the estimated loss of some 2 million jobs, the unemployment rate could go back up over 9%. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
As Americans focus on their choices in this November's presidential election, the nation's weak economy and continuing high unemployment will be among the most important issues voters will consider. But a critical issue that doesn't often make headlines in this election campaign relates to how the outcomes of the presidential election could affect the future ideological composition of the U.S. Supreme Court. The presidency, with its power to nominate new justices to the High Court, gives the occupant of the White House decisive influence on shaping the makeup of the court and its future decisions. With four Supreme Court justices now over age 70, it's likely that the next president will have the opportunity to nominate one or more new judges to the court over the next 4 years. Of the court's liberal bloc, Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg is 79 and Stephen Breyer is 74. Conservative Justice Antonin Scalia and right-leaning swing Justice Anthony Kennedy are both 76. With Chief Justice John Roberts leading the court to the right on many recent decisions related to corporate power and social justice, the selection of future judges will have a profound effect on shaping the court for a generation. The group People for the American Way recently launched a new program called the Romney Court Campaign to inform voters about the positions GOP candidate Mitt Romney has taken on judicial issues and the likely ideological views he'd look for in a future court nominee should he win the presidency. Your reporter spoke with Marge Baker, People for the American Way's Vice President for Policy and Program Planning. Here she talks about how the outcome of this November's presidential election could affect the future ideological makeup of the U.S. Supreme Court.
The election this year couldn't present starker contrasts between the policies of Governor Romney, were he elected, in terms of where he would move the court, and President Obama, were he elected to a second term, in terms of where he would like to see the court go. I mean, the choices are very clear. President Obama's already nominated two stellar justices with deep understanding of how the law and the Constitution affects ordinary Americans. That's Justices Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan. And Governor Romney, on the other side, has indicated that the justices that he favors are justices like Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas and Justice Alito, and those are part of the hardcore conservative majority in the court that's brought us cases like the Citizens United versus FEC case, which opened the floodgates to unlimited spending by corporations and turns out wealthy, super wealthy individuals to influence our elections. It's the court that brought us the Walmart case, which is a case that said essentially that some corporations can be too big to be sued by in class action for discrimination against women. The court that brought us the Lilly Ledbetter decision that prevented Lilly Ledbetter from asserting her rights to fair pay in the court. So the choices are very stark, and what we think it's important to remind voters is that when you go into the voting booth and, you know, pull that lever or touch the screen, you're voting not just for who is going to be president for the next 4 years, but you're voting also for who is going to be on the Supreme Court for the next 40 years. And so these lifetime appointments to the court can have significant, significant impact on people's daily lives. And we're really concerned about the kind of court that we would get under Mitt Romney were he to become president.
Marge Baker, what's the significance of Governor Romney's appointment of Robert Bork as one of his top legal advisors, serving as chair of his campaign's Justice Advisory Committee? Maybe you could go a little bit into Judge Bork's history, his judicial views, and, of course, the episode where the Senate eventually defeated his nomination back in the 80s.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. This is an individual who was so extreme that his nomination to the Supreme Court was defeated by a strong bipartisan majority. And this is the person that Governor Romney has turned to be his judicial advisor about who we would put on the court. And if you go to romneycourt.com, there's an extensive report that we did that details Robert Bork's very, very extreme positions against a right to privacy, so against a woman's right to choose, and even against the constitutional basis for contraception, who has defended poll taxes and literacy tests, who has criticized civil rights legislation in very stark terms. So this is a person who is very, very far to the right, as I say, so far to the right that his own nomination was defeated by a bipartisan majority, who Governor Romney is now leaning on to advise him on judicial nominations.
Now, when people are thinking about the elections, and certainly a lot of folks around the country are now beginning to focus on their choice, and I think most people are decided, but there's a handful out there they call low-information voters who are not quite sure. But I'm wondering, as you look at your target audience here to bring to their attention the critical issues at stake with the next president and whom they may appoint to the Supreme Court, how are you reaching out to voters to make sure they consider that as a factor in how they decide to cast their ballot this November?
There's a plethora of information that's available on the site, and we're pushing that out to make sure people have the materials in front of them. And then in certain target states, in particular Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, we are attempting to organize events in the community to elevate people's awareness of this issue and engage broader coalitions of individuals and organizations in understanding this issue and carrying this message. We've done some TV ads, in particular during the Republican convention in Tampa. We ran an ad on local stations that really took Governor Romney on his position that he couldn't be considered anti-choice. It was, you know, this was all up to the courts. And we pointed out in the ad, which you can see on the website, that in fact, if it is up to the courts, then the justices that Governor Romney would appoint would undermine women's right to choose and women's reproductive health. So we're trying in any number of ways to get the information out to help carry this message. To a certain extent, this year is perhaps a little different than previous years. This information is starting to break through, and poll after poll is suggesting that the American people basically trust President Obama more than they do Governor Romney to nominate justices who will be fair-minded and balanced. And so we're not pushing against a closed door in any way. We're pushing against a door that's opening, and people are starting to understand how important the court can be. I think to some great measure it's because we unfortunately have everyday examples in front of us, you know, especially in the battleground states, of how much money is being poured into this election by special interests in order to essentially buy the elections. And those are all forces that have been unleashed by the Supreme Court in the Citizens United versus FEC case. So although people may not know the name of the case, Citizens United, they understand what's going on, and they understand that at its roots, it's because the Supreme Court has unleashed these forces, and they don't like it.
That was Marge Baker, Vice President for Policy and Program Planning with People for the American Way. Find links to the group's Romney Court campaign on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Not long before the first of three presidential debates was held on October 3rd in Denver, Colorado, three corporate sponsors of the debates announced they were pulling their support for the highly rated nationally televised election program. The three companies, Philips Electronics, BBH New York, and the YWCA, withdrew their sponsorship in response to a campaign by supporters of Libertarian presidential candidate Gary Johnson, who was excluded from the debate, and other groups critical of the Commission on Presidential Debates, a private corporation established by the Democratic and Republican parties. Philips North America spokesperson Mark A. Stevenson told the Politico News website that the company doesn't want to provide even the slightest appearance of supporting partisan politics. This follows a campaign launched by the group Open Debates and 17 other public policy organizations demanding that the Commission on Presidential Debates publicly disclose the secret debate contract that was negotiated by representatives of the Obama and Romney campaigns. The contract defines the format, participation, and how critical questions will be handled within the debate structure. George Farah, founder and executive director of the group Open Debates, charges that the Commission on Presidential Debates undermines U.S. democracy because the group serves the interests of the nation's two major political parties and not the public interest of the American people. Your reporter spoke with Farah, who explains why his group and others are demanding full disclosure of the secret contracts that organize the presidential debates and how the system of political debates could be reformed.
Since 2004, I've been calling on a boycott of various sponsors. We've engaged in letter writing and email campaigns pushing the various sponsors to terminate their and withdraw their support of the commission. The commission is usually sponsored by between 8 and 10 different companies every 4 years, every election cycle. Anheuser-Busch is by far and away the biggest contributor to the commission, has given millions of dollars to the commission. So in many ways, our presidential debates are brought to you by Bud Light. And we have repeatedly called on these sponsors to withdraw their support and have failed. This election cycle, with the help of another nonprofit that was uniquely created this election cycle to make this happen, Help the Commission is its name, and with the infusion of energy from the Libertarian parties and their outrage at the exclusion of their particular nominee, Gary Johnson, this kind of trifecta of a force resulted in an unprecedented letter writing and email campaign. It was unprecedented in scope. And because of the social media, it ricocheted throughout the Internet, and it actually worked so far. Within the last week, 3 of the 10 sponsors have terminated their support for the Commission on Presidential Debates and have issued various statements that YWCA's was the most aggressive, saying that they're an organization committed to peace and justice and therefore no longer can be affiliated with the Commission. And the most muted version of it was Philips Electronics, the tech giant. They simply said, you know, although we think the commission is nonpartisan, we understand that there are millions of people out there who think it's partisan or bipartisan, and we can't be affiliated with such an entity. This is fantastic news, and it's the beginning of tangible effects of our efforts and the efforts of allies and, you know, third parties around the country, from the Green Party to the Constitution Party, Libertarian Party, to raise the public consciousness about what's actually happening. And we're seeing, it's wonderful to see. It's a triumph for the debate reform movement, and I think one of the milestones in the coming election cycles for transformation of the process.
What are the major weaknesses that you have seen in recent debates between presidential candidates? What are the questions not being asked? What's the problem with the format that these two parties have hammered out in secret?
To me, there are 4 critical issues. You know, the first is the formats themselves. Because the candidates are terrified of making a mistake in front of tens of millions of voters, they do whatever they can often to sanitize the debate formats, to eliminate the possibility of unpredictable questions, and to really allow themselves to deploy a series of memorized sound bites in the debates. And so if you look at the contract, you'll actually see provisions that say the candidates cannot ask each other a question. You know, so there's no likelihood that Mitt Romney's going to ask Obama to make a $10,000 bet. Some debate contracts even say the candidates can't talk to each other. If you look at the town hall format, the first town hall debate was in 1992. The audience members could ask whatever they wanted. No one knew what they were going to ask. They were able to ask follow-up questions, and it caused a little bit of a firestorm because they caused President Bush at the time to stumble. Well, now, the town hall debate, all the contracts say that each question asked in the town hall debate must be submitted in advance to the moderator. The moderator throws out the ones he or she doesn't like, and then the actual audience member can only ask that question if it's approved by the moderator, and the moderator points to them. And then the microphone is turned off and they can't ask a follow-up question. In other words, in large part, the audience members are props because the moderator is still selecting all the fundamental questions. So you have these, you know, in 1996 they banned follow-up questions. Each presidential debate contract is a little bit different, but by and large, they're prohibiting actual, real debate between each other. They're eliminating the possibility of them getting past a memorized soundbite. The second issue, of course, is the exclusion of third-party candidates. My organization strongly advocates for the inclusion of every candidate that's on enough mathematical ballots to have a chance of winning the presidency that the vast majority of Americans want to see. If a majority of Americans want to see a candidate, what right does a private corporation financed by Anheuser-Busch and controlled by the two parties to say to the American people no? How is that, you know, if the American people only want to see 2 candidates, we want just 2 candidates on that stage. If they want to see 4, we think there ought to be 4. The child of the sponsors to reflect the aspirations of the American people. And the last thing I'll quickly mention is the limiting of debate. Each contract says the candidates cannot participate in any other debate by any other sponsor with any other candidate. And that doesn't make any sense. We have 27 Republican primary debates sponsored by a multitude of organizations. Abraham Lincoln and Stephen Douglas had 8 debates in 1858. We're facing an unemployment crisis, complex foreign policy issues. Why are we rationing the debates? They're an antidote to money, and they allow the voters to actually make informed choices. So those, I think, are the 3 principal criticisms. The format's being sanitized, candidates are being excluded, and there's just not enough debates.
That was George Farah, founder and executive director of the group Open Debates, and author of No Debate, How the Republican and Democratic Parties Secretly Control the Presidential Debates. Visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org to learn more about the campaign to reform the system of U.S. presidential debates. Last week, a group of local Texas environmental activists and their supporters from around the country began a nonviolent direct action protest to stop construction of the 435-mile southern leg of the Keystone XL pipeline, which is scheduled to be built between Cushing, Oklahoma, and Port Arthur, Texas. The pipeline is being built to bring tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada, to refineries on the Gulf Coast. Some protesters have been arrested, while others are maintaining a tree sit on the property where construction has begun. The Keystone Pipeline is organized into a four-phase project. The first two phases were completed a few years ago. The company constructing the pipeline, TransCanada, hoped to build Phase 3, the portion from Texas to Oklahoma, and then move on to build Phase 4, the pipeline that will extend into Canada. The Obama administration delayed approval of Phase 4, pending further environmental review. That was in response to one of the largest environment-themed protest campaigns in many years that included the arrest of more than 1,200 persons in a series of nonviolent civil disobedience actions in front of the White House just over a year ago. That protest was followed by a November action where some 10,000 activists surrounded the White House in order to persuade Obama to put a hold on the project. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Ron Seifert, a spokesperson with the Tar Sands Blockade Coalition, who talks about support for and opposition to the pipeline project in Texas and the latest news on the protest actions there.
One of the primary concerns we face from East Texans and, well, Texans in general, is how this pipeline will affect their limited water supply. We all know Texas is a drought-stricken region, although East Texas tends to be a little greener and have a little bit more water than most of the state. It's not the typical desert western environment that we're used to seeing in the cowboy movies. Nonetheless, this pipeline will cross all the major water sources for the big metro areas in Texas. People don't necessarily know that this product, tar sands, is not crude oil. It's a different substance. It's a synthetic slurry. Tar sands is solid in its natural state, so it has to be boiled and diluted with chemicals, gas condensates, and all sorts of nasty, carcinogenic, toxic chemicals. And additionally, it's pumped at very high pressure, at over roughly 1,200 psi, 50% higher pressure than a conventional pipeline. So you have this melted, liquefied sandpaper mixed with toxic chemicals that's being blasted at high pressures through a steel pipe. It's a recipe for disaster. So clean water, and not to mention the arable soil in East Texas, are certainly parts of our commons and our environment that Texans hold near and dear, not only because of what it means to them as farmers and ranchers and landowners in the area, but what it means for their collective communities and their future overall.
Ron Seifert, in terms of jobs, you know, in terms of energy security, importing, where this would be importing energy from Canada rather than from the Middle East. Has the project generated much support among the local population? I guess what I'm asking is, are the protesters out of the mainstream or are locals behind it as well?
Well, there's an interesting conflict of traditionally conservative values that exist around this pipeline battle. Yes, it is the case that in Texas and Oklahoma, there's a lot of support from the ground up for the oil and gas industry and this value of unfettered energy expansion. But there's this also strong traditional conservative value of land rights and property ownership. And now these values are at conflict because of the pipeline. So what have traditionally been strongly protected, constitutionally protected, in fact, land rights, are being trampled in the interest of energy expansion. So when it comes down to it, when local community folks, small town, everyday people that traditionally do support oil and gas have to choose between their own homes and their own ranches and the oil and gas industry, especially at the multinational level, that's not bringing any local support to their economy. You find a lot of folks think this idea of using eminent domain to bolster and increase private gains for private corporations is unacceptable. So from a land rights point of view, you have a lot of folks turning away from this project and supporting eminent domain reform, taking a stand against the idea that a foreign corporation can seize American property for its own private gain and that the government is going to be complicit in that transaction. It's really unconscionable and it's offensive to a lot of folks around here. So we do have this kind of unique alliance where you have environmentalists and climate activists coming at this from one angle and conservatives, some folks that are with more affiliate with the Tea Party politics, feeling that the idea that big government or big corporate multinational industry having these powers, having these tools of eminent domain is unacceptable, that it's a freedom that we're entitled as Americans, the right to our properties, and that they should not be imperiled with such nonchalance.
Can you just please summarize what's been happening with the protest on the ground?
So the tar sands blockade is a rolling, nonviolent civil disobedience campaign. And on multiple occasions, individual blockaders have put themselves in the way of construction to literally stop the Keystone XL pipeline from being built. That's been met with different levels of police response from, in one occasion, the police simply doing nothing and washing their hands of it and walking away and leaving the blockaders to hold the construction site. To the worst case, police brutalizing blockaders, choking them, putting them in stress positions, tasing them, pepper spraying them, virtually torturing them. What's going on now and has been going on for the last week is our aerial tree blockade. It's a tree village and a timber wall that have been constructed spanning over 500 feet of the proposed pipeline route, tying in more than a dozen old growth trees. Nine different blockaders are sitting in trees or along a catwalk of this timber wall, freestanding wall of wood that was constructed in the middle of the forest. And those folks have dug in. They have ample food and supplies for weeks, and they're willing to do whatever they can to stay as long as it takes to stop the pipeline and raise enough awareness to encourage folks not only to come and join them in Texas, but to send a message that resistance is possible.
That was Ron Seifert, a spokesperson with the group Tar Sands Blockade in Texas. Find more information on the campaign to stop the Keystone XL pipeline by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.